So I was listening to this thing about coyotes, because I like to learn things.
Yeah, I like coyotes.
And coyote, you're not supposed to kill a coyote if you see it.
Okay.
Because however coyotes work, killing it can actually lead to an increase in the population rather than decreasing it. So if you see a coyote in your area, you're supposed to do what's called hazing the coyote.
Okay.
Right? Which is supposed to be like make yourself big and scare it and whatever, but I'm imagining like, the coyote through like hazing rituals.
Sure, get out like a paddle.
Right, yeah, get out the paddle, you, like blindfold it, and you like lead it into the middle of nowhere and make it find its way back.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. You gotta like go on like a beer crawl with the coyote. Yeah,
exactly. To help control the coyote population.
All right, welcome back.
Could you imagine Bob Barker at the end of The Price is Right? Make sure your coyotes are properly hazed. Help control the coyote population.
Welcome back to the Beyond Sunday podcast. We're exploring how to take our faith beyond Sunday morning. This is Patrick Nazaroff. And with me, as always, Pastor David Bazer.
Hey, Patrick, how we doing?
And no, Katie Phillips. Yeah, we've been talking for the last couple weeks, and Katie is...
We talked it up.
Is not going to be with us. This was her last day in the office on day of recording.
Yeah.
So it's a sad day for us all.
She did not want to spend her last few hours recording with us.
Yeah.
It's very sad.
I know.
I feel a little
she wanted
bit
to,
offended.
Quote unquote, pack her stuff and
get my work done.
Yes. Ridiculous.
Prepare for the future of this ministry. Whatever.
Yeah. Support the teachers that are teaching Sunday school.
Yeah, come on. They'll be fine.
Jeez Louise. Yeah. Sink or swim, people.
That's right. To all you Sunday school teachers out there, you are our future. Thank you for all that you do. Yeah.
So, so for at least the time being, it will be myself and Pastor David.
Yeah.
We may be bringing in some new guests. We may not be able to bring in some new guests.
Who knows?
But for at least the time being.
The world is our oyster.
Yeah. We will not have a third co-host permanently for at least a while. But we're still bringing quality podcasting.
That's the goal.
Well, podcasting, at least.
Yeah. It will be a podcast.
We are also aware that we've had some sound issues over the last couple of weeks.
We
are. Yeah.
We're trying something new.
Our mic has been acting up on us. We're trying something new. We're hopeful this works.
Replacing it with a gym.
I did a test earlier and it worked.
So we'll see.
Yes. And if this does not work, then we might have to be investing in some new equipment.
Yeah. If there's one thing that doing this podcast over the last 76, 77 episodes now has proven, it's that no amount of testing can prove that it's actually going to work.
That is true. It's kind of how life works, right?
Yeah.
All right, well, before we get to our main story this evening, I've got some news.
Aww.
Oh, yeah. All right.
We'll edit that in or something.
Yeah, I'm not editing that. Are you familiar with Axe Body Spray?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Axe Body Spray came out, this is going to date me a little bit, came out when I was in college, I think, is when it started. When it really gained popularity. So it was quite the thing.
I am not an Axe body spray user, but I'm very familiar. It is used by a lot of, teen kids to try to smell good.
Yeah. The cabin at a middle school retreat is just one big cloud of Axe. It's pretty gross.
B.O. and Axe just, all combined, and it does not...
I actually just go ahead and come out with a B.O. scent.
Basically
would be the same thing.
Yeah. If you are a teenage boy listening to this, Axe does not cover your B.O.
Yeah, nor does it smell good. So use something else.
Yes.
Also take a shower.
Correct.
And wash your hands because, coronavirus.
Yes. Florida 7th grader sends 41 to hospital when he mistakes pepper spray for body spray.
Oh, he sees a can of pepper spray.
Uh-huh.
Thinks it's Axe body spray.
Correct.
Starts spraying it all over.
Sprays himself.
And others.
This was after playing football.
Sure.
So in the gym, sprayed this body spray to try to smell good for the ladies. And here it is. 41 now go to the hospital.
Ooh, that's rough. That is probably the only way to make Axe body spray worse.
Yes.
Just turn it into pepper spray.
Yeah, the student said, I felt like a burning feeling in my chest and throat, and I was barely able to breathe and talk.
Sure.
Someone threw up. It looked like blood, but somebody threw up. Oh, my gosh, what a terrible situation.
Yeah, let's not keep reading that. That sounds gross.
Yeah.
It was bad. We'll just leave it at that.
the student will face appropriate disciplinary consequences, according to the principal.
So if you were the principal, what would the appropriate disciplinary consequence for this situation
be? I don't know. Sometimes it's like experience is the best teacher.
I feel like you've suffered enough already.
You got it.
Yeah. These 41 people are already going to hate you for at least the next 2 weeks because it's high school.
Have you ever experienced pepper spray?
I have not.
Me neither. I have friends who have gone to the police academy, and they say part of their training is they have to get tased and pepper sprayed.
Yeah.
So they know what it's like when they do that to somebody else.
I think that's appropriate.
Yeah.
Kind of like doing the shock collar thing on your dog.
Yeah, on yourself.
Yeah, you're supposed to do it on yourself first.
Sure. Or, I guess try the brand of dog food that you're going to give to your...
No, I'm good.
Yeah. You don't try your kitty's food?
Well, I assume that we have different tastes.
Yeah.
But we have similar experiences to electrical shock. So.
Sure, yeah, fair enough. Fair enough. Well, my friend who's a police officer did tell me that tasing hurt, but pepper spray was way worse.
Yeah, I believe it. Because it's got that like lingering.
Yeah, it just stays with you. And there's nothing really you can do. The tasing, once it's like once the taser is gone, you start to get better fairly quickly.
Sure.
But the pepper spray just is there and there and there.
Yeah. I mean, who hasn't accidentally stuck their finger in an electrical socket?
Fair enough.
We've all basically been tased. It's fine.
Yes. Yeah. So keep that in mind.
Kids, don't do that at home.
Yeah, yeah.
This is Beyond Sunday, covering our butts. Don't stick your fingers in electrical sockets.
So yet another reason to not bring Axe with you on campouts and mission trips. You could have confused it for pepper spray.
Yeah.
Send everybody to the hospital. Don't do that. Nobody wants that.
Yep. Yeah. Also, don't bring axes with you on campouts. Well, maybe on campouts. Not
unless,
on mission
unless
trips.
Needed. Yeah.
Yeah. Not on mission
unless
trips.
It's on the packing list. When in doubt, check
look at
the
packing
list. Yeah.
Which I can guarantee will not say Axe body spray.
It will definitely not. It will say BOD. Body spray.
Is that a thing?
That's a thing.
Yeah. Oh, man.
All right, let's get to our main story this
what are we
evening.
Gonna do?
All right, so.
What are we talking about today, Patrick?
We are talking about church.
Oh.
Communion.
Are we talking about taking our faith beyond Sunday morning?
Oh, yes. We came up with a list. Pastor David and I came up with this list.
Yeah.
10 ways.
Our own top 10.
Our own top 10. 10 ways to organize religion. Can hurt your faith.
Ooh.
So these are 10 ways that maybe church abuse happens or things that can happen that could prompt somebody to leave a church or faith community.
Yeah.
And so we came up with
10. Or it can just do damage to your faith. Even if you don't leave,
it can still be damaging.
Harmful to your faith.
Yes.
Yeah.
So things to look at. So a Lifeway research poll did research on why people leave churches.
Lifeway, like the store Lifeway?
Yeah, they do research
too.
It's probably not as in-depth as Barna or Pew.
I didn't know that.
Pew, Pew. but Lifeway does research as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So
they got more time now because they don't have the stores.
Do you want to guess what the most likely reason people is to move to leave a church?
Most likely reason people leave a church, I'm going to go with... probably moving.
Yeah.
It seems to make the most
sense. A life change happens.
Yeah.
They leave if they have to move and find a new home. So.
Yeah. I'm guessing somewhere behind that would be like, I didn't like the preaching style.
Yeah. So 48% leave church because of moving. Okay. 19% says preaching style changes.
Wow. All right.
So that's the power of the pastor, I guess.
Yeah.
12%.
Well, it's the power of the preaching style.
Power of the preaching.
Yeah. Multiple. You could find another pastor that.
Yep.
Fits your mold of preaching style. Yeah.
12% leave church when the pastor leaves.
Yeah.
Or 12% of leavers leave because of pastor.
Yeah. Leaves. Not, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
9% leave due to politics, 5% due to music changes, and 4% because of personal conflicts.
Personal conflict, okay.
Yes. So any insights there before we move into our top 10 list?
You and I talked about this a little bit off air. I think that moving...
Yeah.
Or like a significant life change, we'll describe it as that, whether that's moving or marriage or something like that.
Yeah.
I think for me, that's the only legitimate reason on here to leave a church without having a whole lot more explanation as to what's going on.
Sure.
The preaching style should not be the thing that's holding you in a community of faith. If that's what's holding you in the community of faith is not doing its job.
Correct.
Supporting you.
Yeah.
And same with worship style, etc. Personal conflict, I would hope that if you're leaving over personal conflict, you've taken steps to try to rectify that first. You're not just taking your ball and going home. But if you've taken steps to rectify that and it's just not happening, then I get that. But without further explanation, I would say that leaving is the only one that I would say, that's a good reason to leave the church.
All right, so let's take a look at our top 10 list.
Do it.
And then,
should we start at 10 and work our way up?
Well, we didn't really keep these in like that kind of top 10 list.
Oh,
so
okay.
we'll start at one.
This is a list of 10 things.
List of 10 things in no particular order.
Right.
Not in
number five.
Yeah.
Start there.
Why not? All right, so number one we have here, a reason to leave a church would be church abuse.
Ooh.
All right, so how would you define that, or how would you explain church abuse?
You want a serious definition, or you want me to make a joke first?
Both. Yeah.
All right, so the joke would be when you like walk in and the doors start closing on you every time and you get hurt by the church. That would be the church abuse.
Okay. Yeah.
The serious thing would be the ways in which churches intentionally or unintentionally cause you harm, right? I mean, this can be We put a different one for clergy.
We did.
Okay, so we won't talk about that. But this could be the ways in which churches treat their volunteers.
Sure.
If they're not giving volunteers ample time for rest and rejuvenation and just pushing. Mm-hmm. This could include the ways in which churches talk about its membership or talk about the expectations of its membership. Mm-hmm. It could be burdens that it put. It could be physical, right? I mean, there could be places in the church where individuals or groups are committing some sort of physical abuse. We'd certainly hope that that would not be the case. But those are all kind of examples of church abuse. And some of these are cross categories too.
You know, we'll probably come back to a few of these, how this is going to experience. Yeah, I definitely see that like being burnt out and no space for rest, reconciliation, or an inability to be vulnerable with the people around you without fear of being – without legitimate fear of being – harshly treated, judged, bullied, all these things can happen in churches.
Yeah, if you open yourself up to your church and you say, hey, this is something I'm wrestling with, or this is even something I'm doubting or struggling with, and if you're met with hostility and anger and, you know, a shame, or we're going to get back to shame in a little bit, if you're met with those things, those would all be symptoms of church abuse. That's not a healthy environment.
Yeah, so this could range from major infractions to minor infractions repeated over and over and over again. Sure. So, you know, church abuse could lead to, and I think one of the things that church abuse sometimes we forget too is church abuse also can happen from the congregation to the staff.
Absolutely.
That an expectation of staff that's unrealistic, no space for taking care of oneself or one's family, or even I think a version of church abuse is not paying people a living wage and expecting them to be okay with it. I think that could be a version of church abuse.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, churches have an implicit power that's given to them, right? And so we hire people and we want people to work for us, but we want people to work for the church. And so, we are both fortunate to be working at Lord of Life, which is does a good job of compensating its employees fairly. A lot of congregations are not in that position, either willingly or unwillingly. There might be places that just simply cannot afford to.
Yeah.
There are other places that easily could afford to and choose not to because they expect people to work for the church. And the people who work for the church should have a life of simpleness and poverty, but I can do whatever I want with my money. And, and that's not a healthy scenario by all means. In fact, I don't have a statistic on this, but just anecdotally, the number of stories that I hear from pastors, particularly pastors who are serving in solo parishes, where a pastor is serving by him or herself, it can be really, really difficult and very isolating. You know, you're in a small community. You're probably new to that community. Mm-hmm. Many of the people that you know are people in the congregation.
Yeah.
And they can be holding a lot of your life by a very, very thin thread, and that can be very threatening and very harmful to everybody in the community, not just to the pastor or staff member at that point.
Speaking of pastors, it can also go the other way. So our number two on our list is pastoral or clergy abuse. And we'll really kind of lump in most church workers could be in this.
Sure.
Especially people who are working in ministry, could be a part of this. So how would you understand this idea of like pastoral abuse could happen to somebody in a church?
Sure. So I think, what we kind of jump to when we hear pastoral abuse or clergy abuse is something of a physical or sexual nature.
Yes.
Certainly a very real thing. Yeah. Not really what we're talking about with this particular category.
We're saying that is something so obviously so extreme, so big that legal authority is potentially getting involved. This is not this podcast.
Yeah. This one, when we're talking about pastoral abuse or clergy abuse, we're talking more about ways in which pastors or people who are in ministry positions can kind of misuse their power, and so it can be as simple as, calling volunteers for something and kind of where does the line cross from encouraging people to use their gifts to kind of coercing people into something they don't actually want to do but feel like they can't say no because, quote unquote, the pastor called them, right?
Sure.
And we can certainly inadvertently play that card over and over. We can do pastors can do a great deal of damage from the pulpit and the way they talk about issues that come up before the congregation. Pastors can have a great deal of power at the end of life and how they help people cope with that process or not cope with that process. I think there's a lot of ways in which how pastors handle situations and how they treat them. It can be very dangerous.
Agreed. Yeah, you definitely hit the nail on the head of how this can look. And sometimes I think pastors do this unintentionally. And I think a good sign that maybe you're falling into this trap, as for all our pastoral listeners, is if you're asking people to do a volunteer, this what it's encouraging or coercion, And when it comes time to actually volunteer, they don't really follow through or do it. Sure. Or you're passing their names onto another ministry and that person calls them and they say no. That means they only want to say yes. They're only saying yes because the pastor asked them. Yeah. They have no actual real desire to do that. And that is that form of coercion, you know, like that. So I think that can be part of that. Yeah, I think...
And it's a fine line, too.
Yes.
Sometimes people need...
A kick in the butt.
Right.
Yeah.
Sometimes you need a little coercion to get you into gear to something that you...
Yeah.
Are actually going to end up loving and want to try.
Sure.
But pastors and people in ministry need to be very aware of that. And members of congregations need to be aware of their own boundaries.
You know, sure.
Members of congregations are as responsible for setting boundaries as pastors are for acknowledging those boundaries. And so, you know, I hope that people feel comfortable telling me no to things, right?
Yes.
If I call and lay out a great case of why I think they should be involved in something, I hope they feel comfortable saying that's not what I'm feeling, or I don't have time for that right now, or, you know, and I hope that I respect that as well, right? Now, I hope that if I'm calling over and over with opportunities that eventually we're going to find something that they fit and feels good for them and feels right, because I want people to be connected and make that happen, but... It's a two-way street, though. We need to set up our boundaries in a healthy way, and then those boundaries need to be respected.
Yeah, I think pastors that cannot hold confidentiality, pastors that have, again, an unrealistic expectation for its members of saying, well, I work X amount of hours for the church every week, therefore all my members have that same expectation when they have their own jobs and lives and things like that.
Sure.
I think that can be a forms of pastoral abuse that can easy to permeate. And I don't think necessarily come from... necessarily a bad place, this mindset of like we want people to be involved, engaged, and plugged in, but I think it can quickly get to be a bad place.
I think it too, for a lot of pastors, I think it can happen subconsciously.
Yeah.
That, you know, it becomes a piece of an attitude where, you know, we're coming up to Holy Week here, and let's just be honest, right? I've described Holy Week as like the Super Bowl for pastors. Like, this is what we gear up for all year long. So, I'll work a 100-hour week in Holy Week, and I'll work a lot of long hours in the weeks leading up to that because that's the season that we're in. And so that can, if I'm not careful, if I'm not taking care of myself, that can feed into my attitude and that can feed into my expectation of others. And that's, it's not healthy and it's not fair. And so I might not come out and say, well, you should be here more often because I'm here more often. I might not say that out loud, but I might say it with my eyes. I might say it with my attitude, right? I might, and that's also not helpful. And so as people in ministry, we need to be very aware of that and how we're laying that out for others. Cause you know, we've said this before, I think on the podcast, maybe I've just said it in my own life, but it takes years to build a bridge and it takes a moment to light a fire, right? You know, you can burn that bridge so fast and, you know, a single look can really do a lot of damage. And that could be gone after years of work to try to build those relationships.
Yeah, I think that this might be one, these first two topics, we might be one we come back to at a later date. So I think we have, there's some richer things in there, but we're going to move on our top 10 list for the sake of time.
To number 7.
To number 3.
Oh, okay. I thought we were doing no particular order. So
yeah, I'm still, you know, it's still, this is how we count in America.
Fine.
So, number 3. So if your church has an emphasis on shame or guilt-based theology, whether this is from the pulpit or not, these can be a way that organized religion can damage and hurt your faith.
Absolutely.
And maybe a sign to say, like, hey, is this church really a place you want to plug into? Yeah. So what does that mean?
So let's talk about guilt first, because I think that's a healthy place to start. There are appropriate times that churches should encourage you to feel guilty.
Yeah.
Right? Because at the core of our theology is the fact that we are a sinner, that we're broken, that we're part of a broken world, and that we need redemption. And there are things that we do and participate in that we should feel guilty for. If that's the only thing that you are hearing, or if that guilt is leading you to a place of constantly feeling like you are the scum of the earth and you are unredeemable, right? If the church is promoting a theology that says you are beyond redemption, this is where we get into shame territory.
Yeah.
And that it's just not healthy, it's not helpful, and it's not a reflection of the story of the Bible, right? You know, over and over we see people who appear to be beyond redemption being redeemed. That's the story that we see. And so, you know, if that's all you're hearing and if it's just over and over, we know what shame feels like, right?
Yeah.
We all have a sense of that. And we just have to be very, very aware of that. I don't think it's the church's job to shame anyone.
Yeah.
I think the church, I think guilt has a role.
Sure.
I think different denominations emphasize guilt differently, right?
Yeah.
Sometimes we'll hear expressions like, oh, I've got a good dose of Catholic guilt or something like that, right?
Yeah.
But I think guilt has a role because we have to acknowledge our brokenness. But shame does not have a place in the church.
I think this too, whenever you see churches that are using guilt and shame against the community around them or the culture around them, I think that's also really a sign of like, is this really a place that is seeking to redeem the world, or is it a place that's seeking to like build up a wall between them and the outside world? And I would not personally, I would not want to be part of a church that's only seeking to build up a wall. That and this would be churches that are constantly guilting or are shaming outsiders,
right?
Or you know, through generalizations, through lumping people together in big groups and saying this is what the world does or teaches without proper foundation, I think, in scripture, and without even the intent of like the redemption found in Jesus Christ is not just for the insiders of the church, it's for the outsiders of the church too. And that's our ultimate desire. So I do think if a church is practicing heavily in this shame-based theology, that's leaning hard on that guilt without the promise of redemption attached to it, this could be a place that really can damage your own
life. Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. If you find yourself in a congregation where that's the message that you're receiving, I highly urge you to look for something else.
Yeah.
Have a conversation with someone, you know, find out something, because that is, it's not a reflection of who we believe God is or how God is at work in the world. And it's not a healthy place for your faith to grow and flourish.
Okay. So number four here, another way organized religion can hurt your faith is, this is an interesting one here that we kind of looked at. And that is how your church operates with your family and spouse. Because we both understand when you come to church, you're not just coming as an individual. If you have kids, you're coming as a parent. If you have a spouse, you're coming as a husband or wife.
Yep.
That's how you're bringing those things into church with you.
Yeah.
And so, and so how, and
sometimes those things are noisy.
Yes. How can your church do a bad job of like honoring those things?
You know, for me, a big one, and this is not just because I'm a parent, but it's particularly because I'm a parent, is how does a congregation welcome kids?
Sure.
Right. You know, if you're a family and you have young children and you do not feel welcomed in worship, if you're being told where the nursery or the cry room is, not out of compassion, but out of you really should go to the nursery because you're making too much noise. Or if you're just picking up signs that your kids are just not welcome space, maybe you have a child with you know, different learning abilities, right? And so they don't learn the same way in Sunday school, or they don't sit quietly and perfectly still during church, or whatever that might be. If this is not a community that's willing to surround you and support you in that, I think that can do a lot of damage to you and to their faith, because they're going to pick up on that when they're very, very young. They're going to understand when they're welcomed and when they're not welcomed.
Yeah, absolutely. Not everybody's family is too people that have been practicing Christians from when they were babies to now. And if you feel like my spouse is not welcome with me at church or my kids, there's no place for them here at the church, I think that can be a damaging place. Even if you're like, I have great connections, I have a great love, this is a great place for me. If it's not a great place for those people around you, I think you will experiencing faith damage in very subtle ways. And maybe one of those faith damages is your family hates the church that you go to.
Right.
And now it becomes a source of conflict all week of like, we cannot agree that this is a place that's giving us life.
Right.
And I think that it may not be your church is bad. It just is a place that like, this is, if there's no programming or opportunities for your kids to be involved.
Yeah.
And they're just supposed to sit there looking pretty. Yeah. Kids don't do that. Mm-hmm. And so like, that can be an expectation that's just not true.
Yeah, and I think that there's a challenge there, right? I mean, if you're in a congregation where there's not an active and thriving youth ministry program or children's ministry program, you know, that might be because they need that bit of life to get something going.
Yeah.
And so maybe there's an opportunity to step into something that's a challenge or step into something new. Not everybody has that particular entrepreneurial spirit, and not everybody has that desire. But I think that's something to consider. But at the same time, I think you'll know if the congregation is a congregation that's going to welcome your family, it's going to be a congregation that's going to welcome other families.
Yeah.
Because if your family is there and you're looking around, you're like, oh, we're the only ones with kids under the age of 18 here or something like that. And you're getting, you know, side glances and shush and, you know, being told to go to the nursery. Yeah, that's going to be a culture thing that might be harder to change than just, oh, we just need bodies to start a children's ministry, right? Yeah. But if you're walking into a door and people love your kids and, you know, your kids quickly have four adopted grandparents who, you know, sneak them Werther's originals during the sermon or whatever, you know, then this is a place that wants to welcome kids and just maybe hasn't had the capacity to do that yet.
Yeah.
Maybe you can be a part of something exciting there.
Yeah, all right. Number five. If you have...
Cruising.
Yeah, we're... moving along here. Yeah. If you have conflicting visions with church leadership, and this one we debated
we've gone back and forth.
Pre-podcast here, even if it should be on the list, but I think it should, at least worthy of discussion.
Patrick got final editing on the list, so it's on there.
And I typed the list, so it's on my list. So, but I do think it's worthy to discuss.
All right,
if we disagree.
You start it off, and then I'll disagree.
Okay. Well, I do think if you and your church have a vision, you know, for your community, whether that's an evangelistic vision, whether that's these are the vulnerable people that we want to pursue. And I think this comes with kind of this, what we mentioned earlier, if your church wants to build, circle the wagons around its members, and you're in a place of saying, I want to go forth bravely and boldly into my community, you have a conflicting vision of what you expect church to be on Sunday mornings.
Sure.
And not just on Sunday mornings, what you expect church to be in your life. And if that's if the church is saying, what we have is just Sunday mornings, we circle the wagons, here you are, and you're like, I need something more, I think you have a big enough conflicting vision that you would say, maybe you need to find something different.
And so here's where we agree and disagree on the same point. I would agree that that might be a reason to find a new church.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's a place where that's hurting your faith in the same way that, you know, shame theology or pastoral abuse or not accepting your family would be doing. So I think, I mean, when you're looking for a church home, right, when you've, when you're part of that, what, 49% of people that have moved and are looking for a new church home, you should find a church that has a vision and an alignment with what you're passionate about. Mm-hmm. And so, hopefully you find that place. And then hopefully if you're there for 20 years, you're a part of that visioning process for the congregation going forward. I just don't see this one doing as much harm as just being a reason to say, okay, we're going different directions and it's time to part ways. And in the same way that, you know, I have friends with whom I, you know, had a huge fight and blew out and never talked to again. And then I had friends who said, you know what, we're going different ways and we love each other. And if we see each other again, it'll be great, but we're just going different ways. And that's an okay thing too.
See, and this is where we will disagree too, because I think it could harm your faith, especially if those visions are personal visions, like visions of inclusivity, visions of, you know, even like how our theology is interpreted in this world can be damaging if you can't get on the same page. Yeah. I do think there's
I think if you stay and you're trying to fight through this conflict and the conflict is not coming to resolution, then that can certainly lead to damage. Yeah. But I think just the initial our visions don't align.
Yeah.
It is an opportunity to have a healthy parting of ways as opposed to we have to enter into conflict and battle royale until one of us comes out the victor.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yes. All right, so number six, if there's no place to serve.
I
think this is interesting. I actually read a little article on this one.
What do you got?
Well, a guy was just kind of talking about how he retired. He was in the stock business. He retired, and he had a degree in theology and was going to his church and saying, like, hey, I'm retired. I have a degree in theology. I want to be able to help teach. I want to be able to help do these things. And he said, coming out of it, feeling shot down. Like, there was no space for him. The classes were already established. The teaching cycles were already picked, and it's like, well, you can help with, you know, serving communion. And he's like, there's nothing wrong with doing that. And that's not beneath him, but coming to your leadership with the excitement of this is what I want to do.
Yeah.
And I think feeling shot down is damaging.
Do we have this guy's email? Because I'll write him. He can come here. We can put him to work.
Yeah.
We could use another theology degree around here.
Sure.
I think this is a great one. And, you know, maybe this is serving in the building. Maybe this is just not having a place to connect you to service out in the world too, right? I mean, a huge piece of our faith should be connecting our faith to our actions out in the world. And if our congregations are not helping us make those connections, I think that can do a lot of damage for our faith. And we might not feel that damage right away because it can feel very comfortable to stay in a congregation and to, you know, as you've kind of mentioned, circle the wagon, so to speak. But I show up on Sunday mornings, I maybe go to a class, and then I'm done, and I don't think about it for 6 weeks or 6 days. That can feel very comfortable. It can feel very easy, but it can also feel very shallow, and we might not realize just how shallow the faith is until we're thrown into the deep water of a tragic loss or an illness or a death, and suddenly we don't actually know how to swim, even though we've been doing this thing week after week.
I do think that if you come into your church and like, how can we be plugged in and involved? And they look at you and like, I don't really know.
Yeah.
That could be fairly damaging if there's just no place for you to express your gifts in this congregation. All right, number seven.
Was number seven.
No, that was number six.
You said number seven.
Well, this is number seven for real. Okay. All right, so.
Number six.
Our 6.5. All right. This is, I have four more, so this is number seven. All right. Your congregation, whether from the pulpit or in Bible study, is putting politics before the gospel. All right, so talk me about this one here, Pastor.
Yeah, David. So this one was kind of mine, right? I phrased on here. So politics before the gospel, I think, is helpful because the gospel, and when we mean the gospel, we mean the simplest message of Jesus Christ is crucified, died, and risen to save us from our sins, right? That's the heart of the gospel. That's what I'm talking about when I say this. The gospel has implications for how we live out our lives within the sphere of politics.
Correct.
And so you might hear a pastor preach about how the gospel calls us to care for the poor, or how the gospel calls us to care for the elderly, or how the gospel calls us to care for the immigrant in our town. Mm-hmm. Because we can point to places in scripture where we see these things happening.
Yes.
And you might interpret that as political. And I would argue that it has political implications, but it is a gospel-centered message. Mm-hmm. In the inverse to that, if you start hearing from the pulpit political decisions before you're hearing about the gospel of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. You know, you're hearing about how we're called to, you know, ban all guns, for instance.
Yeah.
Or we're called to, I'm trying to think of another just kind of outlandish position.
Sure.
You know, even something like socialized medicine, right?
Taxation.
Taxation, yeah. Right? Yeah. If these are things you're hearing from the pulpit, there might be gospel implications that play into some of these conversations, but if those things are coming before an emphasis on the gospel of Jesus Christ, mm-hmm. I think we've got our wheels crossed.
Yeah.
I think it's going to lead to a crash eventually. And I don't think it's a healthy way to come at politics, nor do I think it's a healthy way to come at faith. Using faith to inform our politics, we've said this before, right? Using faith to inform our politics is an important part of following Jesus Christ. Using politics to inform our faith is a dangerous path.
Absolutely. And I think what we're really trying to say, like we said, is if your church is putting politics before the gospel, this would be a church kind of saying, like, this is who you should vote for.
Sure.
These are the policies that you should find mm-hmm. most important in your mm-hmm. voting decisions, not recognizing the nuance that could be in every person in their congregations or anybody that would follow X or vote for X. Isn't a real Christian, that kind of Christian gatekeeping.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
Those things should all be present in this politics before the gospel.
Absolutely.
And I think what's really seductive and easy is it's hard to see when it lines up with your political leanings.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So if you kind of naturally agree, so if you're, like you mentioned, guns, if you're a naturally
anti-gun person
and you're hearing that from the pulpit, you'd be like, oh, yeah, this makes sense. We should be hearing this in churches because it kind of naturally lines up with what you're already mm-hmm. hearing. And if you're on the right, pro-Second Amendment, and you're hearing the need for protection and the need for people to protect their families, you might be like, oh, yeah, this makes sense because it's already naturally lined up with what I already believe.
Right.
And so that can be very, very seductive.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sometimes hard to spot when you agree.
Absolutely.
But I do think that that is an important distinction to make. And so sometimes a healthy congregation, I think, will have a difference of opinions and that can be fully expressed, fully loved, fully supported within its congregation. So that does not happen.
Yeah. Yeah. The best example that I've heard of this was while I was on internship, my supervisor would talk to me about preaching because we had a politically diverse congregation out in Colorado. And, you know, we had people across the spectrum. And so we would talk about, you know, a welfare scenario, for example, right? You know, Jesus calls us to care for the poor, right? That's a piece of the gospel message. And so it's up to each person individually to figure out how that happens and mm-hmm. how the gospel plays into their political decisions on how that should happen. But whether you're a Democrat or a Republican or a neo-libertarian or whatever, if you are a follower of Jesus, you are called to care for the poor. So if you're a conservative who says we shouldn't have people on welfare, okay, how are you going to care for the poor? And if you're a Democrat or a liberal who says we should have welfare or we should expand welfare, okay, how are you personally caring for the poor? Because it's not good enough for us as people of faith to put that off on the government, nor is it good enough for us as people of faith to expect them to fend for themselves, right?
Sure.
Neither of those are the healthy approach to take there.
Yeah, and I think this leads us to a good one for number eight here. So if your church is homogenous, this can be a sign of spiritual hurt going on inside the church or congregation. So homogeny is when everything is the same. Yep. So things look the same, act the same, dress the same, things like this. So if you're looking around your church and saying, let's pick a demographic and we all kind of are the same, that could be a damaging thing. So one thing we've talked about in the past, we'll continue to talk about because it's still happening, is racial segregation is most prominent on Sunday morning than any other time in the United States. So, but if your church is racially divided, economically divided, again, we're politically divided, if we all are in the same state of life, and everybody's just kind of like, we're building a church for us instead of for the good of our community and around us, I think that that homogeny leads us to some spiritual damage. Can you expand on that?
I think that's a great point. I think, you know, when we look around and we don't have the diversity of believers that fill the body of Christ, I think we're missing out on a piece of that. Now, most often, I think that this happens to churches inadvertently. I don't think churches set out in most cases to intentionally say we want everyone to look and act just like us. But I do think that we have preferences that we bring to the table that result in that.
Yeah.
And so it might be that any given congregation looks and acts a lot like you do. But how is that congregation reaching out to break down those barriers of homogeny? And so does your congregation have a relationship with another congregation that doesn't worship and act like you or doesn't look like your congregation? Do you have a way to exchange ideas and thoughts and experiences with those congregations? You know, you might be in a congregation that's never going to be a racially diverse body because of the community that you serve. You know, that's a possibility. But how are you reaching out to achieve some level of diversity within the community that you serve? In general, you know, I think we want to look for healthy congregations. I think most often the healthiest congregations reflect the community that they're in. In diversity, in makeup, in income, in, you know, age, all of that stuff. I think that's a healthy gauge. And it's one thing that Lutherans have historically been pretty good at until the last 30 to 40 years. But in large part because we built Lutheran churches where there were people that, you know, were Lutheran, right? And so you had a community Lutheran church that was fairly reflective of your community. And then those communities started to change as people moved and neighborhoods changed. And a lot of those churches are really struggling to figure out what that looks like. And, you know, that's it's just a wrestling that we have to keep up with.
Yeah, but if you were thinking one ideology or political point of view would not be welcome in our congregation, that's a big sign of your homogeny is out of control. And that you are cannot embrace the value of different points of view. And that doesn't mean, you know, like just because you want to embrace the community around you that you sacrifice what's valuable and special about the teachings of the gospel. But it may mean for the good of the community around you, your church has to be willing to change and and embrace it, seek it out. Just we're willing to look different as long as everybody acts just like me. You know, like, and as long as they come into our wagons that we've circled, then we're good. But you have to be willing to go out
there. We're really stuck on those wagons today.
Yeah, that's a good analogy, I think.
We're back in the 1800s. This is like my wagon thing last week. We have new technology. You don't have to be trapped in our wagons anymore.
All right, number 9 and 10 kind of go together a little bit. But you're not experiencing, your church is not experiencing transformation. So
I think you should talk about this one. This was yours.
This one was mine. So transformation would mean like your church is not experiencing growth, change, development of any kinds. So this doesn't necessarily mean like you're getting bigger numbers-wise or like your church building is constantly different. But if there's no – you're looking at the last 10 years of your congregation and you're like, how have we grown on any level? And your answer is – I don't know. Then I think you're really you're doing some damage to yourself because you're allowing a complacency to set in, even if you're unaware of it.
In the last 10 years, the same 15 or 20 people have rotated through council positions. Maybe the same handful of people is on Altar Guild every week. Same handful of people are teaching Sunday school, doing the same lessons that they were doing from 10 years ago. And there's just there's no opportunity for you or for others to be transformed in their faith.
Yeah, so I think that that can be part of that. And I think, you know, this can kind of reflect some of these things that come before. There's no opportunities to serve, no places, ways to get involved in your community. There's just a desire for homogeny. It can lead to this, like, you know, transformation is the enemy of homogeny, because that requires things to be different and change. Yep. And so that can be damaging, because now it's saying, like, we don't want things to change. We'll just kind of ride this out until we're all dead. Yep. It's kind of just not exactly...
it's not a healthy place to be.
Yeah.
It's not a healthy way to live our faith.
And then finally, number 10 is there's a lack of joylessness. There's joylessness. There it is. Lack of joy or joylessness in your community.
Yeah.
Yes. So, what do you think about this one?
You know, joy is an underrated emotion.
Agreed.
I think too often we confuse joy with happiness.
Yeah.
And that is not what it's about. Joy is deeper than that. Joy is... you know, I've kind of described it as that thing that's running through all of it, through any experience that we have this opportunity for joy because God is still present in that. Even in the darkest moments, God is still present. And so there's an opportunity to experience joy, even though we're not going to be happy in those moments.
Yeah.
You know, happiness is this facade that we put on for others, but joy is the thing that really girds our spirit. Is that a thing? Girds?
Yeah, sure.
You gird your loins. Is that just a mispronunciation of guard?
No, I think it's different.
All right.
Yeah.
So joy is the thing that girds our spirit. And so, yeah, I think that's if you're in a place where there's just no opportunity to experience the joy of Christ.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, if you're sitting around on Easter morning and when we get to the part of saying he's risen indeed, and there's no joy in the room, you know, it might be monotone. We're Lutherans, sure. Right? It might be monotone, but you can still tell when there's joy, when there's when there's an opportunity to experience that joy. Yeah. In the same way that you can see that throughout the ministries, right? If everything is a burden, if everything is just another task that has to be done, I mean, we know what joylessness is because we've all felt joylessness.
Yeah.
And when we have that permeating the life of a church, I think that can do a lot of damage to our faith because we're not having the opportunity to experience the things that God has called us to. And one of the things that God has called us to is an experience of joy.
Yeah, definitely. Coming from the pulpit, if there's just no joy or passion or excitement in any level from our pastoral staff, if there's no joy or excitement in the congregation, I think this does real damage. Because I think that this is one that says, like, the Christian faith is not exciting. Mm-hmm. And it's not life-giving. And it's not transformative and changing and bringing goodness into our world. Mm-hmm. It's just a set of rules and expectations that we need to follow. And if you follow those expectations and rules, then I guess good things happen to you, even though you don't experience them as good because it's joyless. Then that's the complete, so far from what Jesus desires and is teaching us in the Gospels, that it really is so damaging. I think this is like, you know, Nietzsche has that famous quote of like, God is dead. But if you continued his thought process, he goes into it, I'm going to butcher this, is like, because the churches are in mourning. Mm. And that meant for him, and then this was, I don't know, 1800, 1700s.
Sometime when Nietzsche was alive.
Long ago. I'm not a... Don't know.
It was definitely not the 1900s.
Yeah. Yeah.
We can knock that one out.
Sure. But him experiencing coming into churches and feeling like it's dead in there.
Yeah.
Like it's just not, there's no excitement or energy in the room at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then that means is what they're worshiping alive, is what they're worshiping on the move, is what they're worshiping exciting.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I would say the answer is no. Yeah. Like you're building God in your own image then. You're seeing God as a joyless robot who's keeping score in heaven and not somebody that's active and on the move in your community who has the power to transform the bad things in this world. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, and one of the things I think that's important about this entire list, all the items on this, is that this is not something that large congregations are immune to or particularly susceptible to, or the same thing for small congregations or rural congregations or suburban congregations or city congregations. Wherever you are, these are signs that churches can do real damage to your faith. Now, we're both church workers.
Correct. Right?
We want the church to be the best thing that it can possibly be. We want you, as a listener, to have an opportunity to connect with a faith community that supports you and encourages you and builds you up. And so, you know, this is where I shamelessly say, come to Lord of Life, because we are perfect in all of these, right?
You know, probably not, but I think...
All right, we're not perfect.
Yeah.
No, but all of our churches run the risk of being susceptible, Lord of Life included, right? We run the risk of being susceptible to this and potentially people perceiving injury even when no injury was intended.
Correct.
And I think that we have to be aware of that and willing to own that also. But if you feel like this is, if you're hearing these and you're genuinely thinking, man, this is really just, it's damaging my spirit at this point. You know, I think it's a time for a serious conversation about what does that mean for you and for your faith? Mm-hmm. Because though the institution was created for good,
yeah,
it can do harm because Absolutely. It is filled with sinners.
Yeah. I do like that you mentioned that this is not one type of church No. that does these things. Yeah. That this is not
now
just,
I can name some churches that I think do it sure, more than others.
Yeah, it's, but it's not just small rural congregations. Right, that's yeah. not just we've yeah. seen over the last 10, 15 years, mega churches implode mm-hmm. seemingly overnight yeah. because of these things were present, even if your general population did not realize it, or your yeah. general congregation yeah. had no idea some of these things were going on, and then all of a sudden this hits. And the church doors close, yeah. and everybody's like, what happened?
You show up Sunday morning and nobody's there. And yeah. saying, well, I can see through the walls of this crystal cathedral, but no one's worshiping yeah. anymore.
So
did that one fall? That one collapsed like overnight, right?
Sure, why not?
I think it did.
Yeah, probably.
We'll look it up.
We've gone.
Yeah.
You can look it up.
I'll look it up. Yeah. No one will know if I do or don't.
Yeah. We'll check it next week.
There you go.
All right, well, I hope our sound quality was better this week.
Yeah. We'll know if it wasn't, so yeah, no need to write in for that.
If not, we promise next week we will have at least a new stuff. Microphone. We'll yeah, have a we'll new microphone. Something. We're trying it out here. All right, where can you find us?
Hey, if you like what you heard, or if you wish that Katie was back, whatever, let us know.
Us too.
Yeah, write us at beyondsundaypodcast@gmail.com. We would love to hear your thoughts on ways in which you've seen churches do any number of these 10 things. Maybe you've got a story about how you left a church because of this, or maybe you've got a story about how you stayed in a church and helped overcome something like this. Yeah. That would be great too. We'd love to hear those stories. Send us an email at beyondsundaypodcast@gmail.com. Be sure to like and review us on all of your favorite podcast providers. You can send this out to your friends, share it from the mountaintops, say, hey, friend, I think that you might need to really listen to number 7. Or say, hey, pastor, I think you need to be aware of how you're abusing your power and listen to number 2. Was it?
Number 2, 3.
Yeah. You know, that's fine. Send it out to people who need to know about the ways in which they're harming other people's faith.
Yeah.
Whatever. We would we'd love to hear that, too. So you can find all our episodes at beyondsundaypodcast.com.
That's it. Yeah. If you want to shame and guilt Katie into returning to us,
do it.
We're on board. Yeah.
Don't use shame theology. Just use shame.
Yeah. it's not connected to a relationship with Jesus.
Right. Don't bring Jesus into it. Yeah. Jesus loves her no matter what, but we will love her more.
Absolutely. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody. We will be back next week.